If we can find ways to stop people getting sick in the first place, not only make people's lives better, obviously, but we save huge amounts of money. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Steve Hilton Show. Happy New Year. Welcome to the first episode of 2024. Lots to get to. By the way, coming up in the show is a great conversation with our friend Jennifer Horn, where we get into what we got up to over New Year's. I think you'll enjoy that very much. But let's get to the big story of the week. And actually, there are two that I'd like to focus on. I've been away for a few weeks. Lots been going on. I kept a little bit of an eye on it. But as I return, it seems to me there are two things that are really kind of dominating what's been in the news. And I've got strong views on both of them. The first story is this attempt to get Trump off the ballot with these court cases. And the second is this, you know, scandal, I would call it, of Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary, which, far from going away, seems to be getting worse with every attempt on the part of the White House and the Defense Department to try and clean it up. So let's start with the Trump situation. I think that, you know, there's something so kind of laughable about the fact that these people who are so opposed to Trump and endlessly come out with this rhetoric, this ludicrous rhetoric about how Trump is a threat to democracy. You know, all the time they talk about threat to democracy. The things they say are so utterly ridiculous, preposterous. I mean, Liz Cheney, I talked about her before in one of her interviews. She literally said that if Trump wins in 2024, it could be the last election you get to vote in. I mean, look, whatever you think of Liz Cheney, she's not a stupid person. Clearly she's not. She's clearly an intelligent person. How can an intelligent person say something like that? Because they're completely deranged. I mean, we use this term Trump derangement syndrome. And it's almost, you know, it's a throwaway phrase. So we don't stop and sort of really think about what that word means. But they really are. The fact that you can have someone like Liz Cheney literally say in public, in an interview, if Trump wins the presidential election, the last election. I mean, what did she even think? I mean, I just cannot imagine what's going on that would lead someone to say something like that. But that's the mentality. And that's, of course, what's driving all these court cases. And they cannot see the irony of the people who claim to be defending democracy, trying to use any means possible, including not just non-democratic, anti-democratic means to take Trump off the ballot. They're obviously doing this based on Article 14 of the Constitution and Section 3, which is the disqualification clause, as we now all know to call it, that because Trump engaged in insurrection, that means he's not quite, whatever. There's all these legal arguments and everyone's been rehearsing them and they're going to go to the Supreme Court now. We know that about whether he counts as, you know, in the text of the Constitution, an officer of the United States or not, whether he needs to have previously been convicted in the criminal courts of insurrection. Those are the arguments are going to be, you know, hashed out by the Supreme Court and others. Fine, let's leave it there. But the two things I want to say that are just so kind of just make me laugh when I think about the situation. First of all these people going on and on about how, and you see these, you know, long articles in the New York Times and elsewhere, all these people who for years have told us that the Constitution is a living document. That's the phrase that they use, a living document. And if you try and take it literally, then you're just living in the past and this is not the 18th century anymore. And we need to, you know, the Constitution needs to be applied to today's circumstances. And it's just completely ridiculous to take the words of the Constitution literally and apply them to today's situation. For years, all these people on the left have been saying that it's a living document. You can't take the words of the Constitution literally. Now, guess what they're doing? All of them, when they write their endless opinion pieces in the New York Times and elsewhere about why Trump should be taken off the ballot, they say, well, look at the literal words of the Constitution, Article 14, Section 3, we must apply these words as written. I mean, it's just such a joke. They have absolutely no principles, whatever, except hatred of Trump and his supporters. The second thing I'd say, just as a, you know, maybe some helpful advice to the Democrats to deal with their very evident Biden problem. And what's the Biden problem for the Democrats? The fact that they're stuck with this absolutely hopeless candidate that most of the country wishes wasn't the most Democrats don't want as the candidate. Clearly senile, clearly incapable of carrying out the job of president now, let alone in another sort of 4.5 years or at the end of what would be a second term. Obviously, they wish they could get rid of him. That is clearly coming out in all these comments, where some of them on the record, like from people like David Axelrod, Obama's former chief strategist. More often, it's behind the scenes briefings and so on. They wish they could get rid of Biden, but they can't see how they could get rid of Biden and replace him with someone else. And of course, then their dilemma is, well, if they get rid of Biden, they're stuck with Kamala Harris and so on. So they're in this dilemma and they don't know how to get out of it. They're stuck with Biden. Here's a friendly suggestion. That section, if you read it, doesn't just talk about insurrection as a basis for disqualifying a candidate. It also talks about anyone who, having sworn an oath of loyalty to the United States, then goes on to give aid or comfort to the enemies of the United States. So there you have it. Perfect grounds for disqualifying Biden, because I don't know how else to describe what he's been doing as president in relation to Afghanistan, to dropping sanctions on Iran and Hamas and Putin over the pipeline, on and on. I mean, what else has he been doing other than giving aid and comfort to America's enemies? So there you have it. Disqualify Biden under Article 14. That's the solution to the Democrats' Biden problem. The second story, just want to quickly touch on this, the Lloyd Austin story. Of course, this is unraveling. Here are the latest developments. I'm taping this on Tuesday, the 9th of January. So what we're hearing, first of all, on a serious note, is that it's clearly a very serious issue that he was hospitalized with. We've just been told that it's prostate cancer, which is something, of course, that we wish him well with on a personal level for his recovery. And the second piece of news that came out this morning is that the reason neither Biden, his boss, was informed about his hospitalization, nor, in a way even more inexplicably, his deputy, who was supposed to take over. She didn't know about it for days. The reason for all this, apparently, we're told, is that the chief of staff or some official, I think it's the chief of staff, they're saying, had flu. And so it just was all a bit late notifying people. It was just right there. The whole thing is a complete shambles. Of course, we wish him well with clearly a very serious illness. But the handling of this, you can't escape accountability for the way it's handled. This is an incredibly important job. And we have attacks on our forces all going on, you know, over 100 just in the last few months. You know, volatile situations around the world, our troops engage. I mean, it's just absolutely a scandal that this is how they've handled it. But it reveals something even worse, and people aren't really making this point or seeing this connection. And this is what I wanted to leave you with. What does it really tell us? Apart from the kind of shambles of the way they've handled it, it tells us something really serious about how they think about government and how our government operates. Because the fact that they're so casual about this, so totally cavalier, oh, it doesn't matter. And especially, this is why I come back to it, the point about the deputy not being told, the person who's supposed to take over. So you have a couple of days where no one's in charge, in terms of someone who's politically accountable. What does that tell you? It tells you that the machine, the bureaucratic machine, is actually in charge. They don't really care. It doesn't make any difference to them whether Austin's in hospital or not, or whether his deputy knows or not. It doesn't matter, because they're the ones actually running the Defense Department. And that's what is really revealed by this episode. The fact that the deep state bureaucrats are actually running the show. That is the real scandal here. So for our policy conversation today, I want to focus on something that we don't really talk about often, but it's incredibly important to everyone and to our economy and to our political arguments. That is healthcare. But I want to talk about it in a completely different way than how we normally think about it. When we have these conversations about healthcare, and remember, this is a huge part of our economy. It's up to, I think, nearly 20% of our economy. There's a huge amount spent on it. It's a huge, you know, consumer of resources, both personal and government resources. The whole healthcare system is just a massive, massive thing, both in the life of our government and, of course, in each of our lives. At the state level, at the federal level, every level, healthcare is a huge thing. But the conversation we have about it in policy terms, in political terms, is incredibly narrow. And it focuses basically on one aspect of it, which is health insurance, which is how do we fund the system that treats us when we get sick. But what we never do is talk about the real truth about healthcare, which is that the most important thing that we should be talking about is how we keep people healthy in the first place. Because we don't really have a healthcare system. We have a sickness care system. And if we can find ways to stop people getting sick in the first place, not only make people's lives better, obviously, but we save huge amounts of money. And our taxes would come down. And we wouldn't have this endless sort of nightmare and bureaucratic, merry-go-round that we all have to engage in, and this sort of bandwidth that we have to devote to healthcare and everything associated with it. And also the burden on business. Think about that. You know, the fact that so many employers, it's a huge part of their costs. So all of that could be drastically reduced and minimized if we thought more seriously about true healthcare. How to stay healthy, how to be healthy, how to live healthy lives. Now, this is a massive subject. I've written about it before in my book, especially in my book, More Human, which came out in 2015, 2016 here in America. And there's a whole chapter on healthcare, and you can read that. And it's all about this theme of how we actually make the healthcare system more human, because what we've ended up with is this giant bureaucratic industrialized system, totally corrupt, where you have these big industries, the health insurance companies, and the now increasingly giant companies that have gobbled up loads of hospitals. So you have big companies, big businesses running hospitals, and you have, of course, the pharmaceutical industry that has an interest in not in keeping us healthy, not in making us healthy, but in treating us with their products when we get sick. So all of that is the background. The reason I wanted to talk to you about it today was I just saw a post on X from a guy called Callie Means, who's fantastic. You may have seen him on my Fox News show, runs an organization called True Med. His background is, you know, he's really knows what he's talking about, worked at Coca-Cola for a time, really saw the kind of deep, deep corruption where you had unhealthy products being pushed to kids and in communities causing massive, massive health problems and the cynicism around all of that. He was a whistleblower there. Now he's really focused on this agenda of how we can help people live more healthy lives. Just did a post today, which I think is really worth reading. I've reposted it on my on X, so you can read it there. And I think it's based on an article he wrote for the Free Press, Barry Weiss's organization. I just want to read you a little extract from it, and then you'll see where he's coming from very clearly. So here's the basically the story that he's that prompted this post is the story of the end of the life of his mother, and how they had to fight so hard to reject the advice being given to them by the medical industrial complex, if you want to call it that, the health industrial complex, in terms of surgeries and operations and more medicine and treatments, all the rest of it, of course, which they would benefit from financially. And they rejected all of that because Callie Means has a sister who's a doctor called Casey Means, and she's very familiar with all of this stuff and said, no, we don't want that. We don't need that. We want the end of our mother's life. She had cancer, to be free of all this kind of heavy duty intervention, which would have kept her in the hospital. Instead, we want to have a more natural death. So, and which they now cherish as a memory of her. But it prompted not just this post, but a book that's coming out in May. But here's the part I wanted to read you about the lessons that they learned. Here's what Callie Means writes in his post. The third lesson was, there is a better way than our current system. And it starts with understanding that the biggest lie in healthcare is that the root cause of why we're getting sicker, heavier, more depressed, and more infertile is complicated. Actually, depression, anxiety, acne, infertility, insomnia, heart disease, erectile dysfunction, type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, dementia, cancer, and most other conditions that torture and shorten our lives are actually rooted in the same thing. And the ability to prevent and reverse these conditions and feel incredible today is under your control and simpler than you think. And it goes on to describe the current interventions, which are always like give you a pill, give you medicine, give you a treatment, sell you something, basically. And then you have the insurance industry that funds it. And that's the kind of system that we're in. And it really takes me back to my time working in the government back in the UK, where, of course, there's because you have a National Health Service, which is universal single-payer healthcare, there's a real incentive to try and reduce the cost because it's all coming out of taxpayer money. It's all funded by taxpayers. You want to try and bring the cost down. So I paid a lot of attention to how you can keep people healthier to reduce the burden on the National Health Service. And actually, I spent endless conversations. I got in all the experts. And what was really interesting is when you get the heart disease experts in and the cancer specialists in and all these people, the Alzheimer's and the dementia, everyone who's real, a world-class experts in all of these illnesses. And they all said the same simple set of things in terms of what you can do to prevent them. And it comes back to those basic things that everyone knows. And it's so simple. It's infuriating that it's not taken more seriously, which is eat a healthy diet, get 8 hours or so of sleep every night, take moderate exercise, drink alcohol in moderation, don't smoke. I mean, that's basically it for everything. And people don't understand enough how connected all these things, cancer and heart disease and Alzheimer's and dementia, all these different things, they all go back to living in that, according to those very, very basic and simple rules. Now, of course, it's hard to live like that. And we all struggle in different ways with different aspects of that, of course. But the real point is that we've created a system that actually incentivizes the wrong kinds of lifestyles. We subsidize. We actually take taxpayer money and hand it out in subsidies to the exact kinds of food and drink that make us sick. It is totally insane. And the thing that drives that is lobbying from the industries that benefit. And so the other incentive where so much of the money goes is not to try and stop us getting these illnesses in the first place, but to treat us when we get them. It's almost like we want people to get sick so that the pharma companies and the hospitals and all these people can make money. The whole system is set up the wrong way. So that is that's the heart of the argument that I made in my book, In More Human, nearly 10 years ago. And there's a book coming out from Callie Means. It comes out in May. The book is called Good Energy, The Surprising Connection Between Metabolism and Limitless Health. It looks super interesting. Callie Means is a great guy. I encourage you to read this article. I posted it on X today. And I hope it's just the start of a real conversation about healthcare that can actually make us healthier and happier and save us all money in the process. All right, now it's time for California Corner. And guess who popped up on my screen as I was welcoming in the new year, this first show of the new year? It's our friend Jen Horn, Jennifer Horn, AM 870, The Morning Answer, Los Angeles and Southern California. And actually beyond, do you remember, Jen, I told you that story of someone who listens to you up here, you know,
in the
Bay Area, Santa Cruz. So you're all over the place.
I pay $20 to everybody who brings me up to you, Steve.
It's very good.
I subsidize their income, you know.
So how are you doing? Did you have a great holiday?
I had a great holiday. It was just over too fast. You know, like Christmas every year, I feel like you finally settle into it and then you blink and it's over. But I have to tell you, you know, you're Hungarian, so I can tell you that on Christmas Eve, I am Czech. I made my grandmother's recipe for dumplings. And I'm not talking about like the Chinese kind. I'm talking about the Czech, Hungarian, Eastern European style, which is like boiled bread. And we had a very great family get together with people I hadn't seen in a long time. And it was just such a special time. You know, the nostalgia of the season is awesome. And then Christmas Day was great. New Year's Eve was fantastic. We had friends over. I stayed home, but it was absolutely lovely. But I missed you. I missed you on our program, The Morning Answer. I missed you
it's
here.
Been ages.
Yeah. How was your
it's
holiday?
It turned out to be a really long. Well, it's when I was looking at it, because it feels like we've been away a long time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long, but somehow about the way, you know, the times we went and came back. So we were in Europe. So we always go back to England at Christmas to see friends and family. We have a few days in London. That was great. That's where we see friends. Then we went to family, and both my wife and I were from Sussex. And so our parents live in Sussex. And so we stay at her parents' place, and then my mom and stepdad can come along. You know, so it all works out really well. That's why we very much resent, just as a little aside, the certain duchess in Montecito still calling herself the bloody Duchess of Sussex.
I'm actually
from Sussex. You're not the Duchess of me.
You're upset about your representation or lack
thereof,
right?
Exactly. So we're in Sussex, which is beautiful. The countryside, very nice. And then we always do a New Year's trip when we're in Europe with friends, the same sort of two separate families. we all get along, kids the same age as our kids, etc. And we've done fantastic, you know, because it's also, you know, it's just very easy to get across the continent, as yeah. they say in England when they talk about the rest of Europe. So this year we were in Spain and we went to Madrid and we were in Madrid for New Year's Eve. And then we had a few days in Barcelona. So it was really amazing.
That's
actually
lovely.
It was so fantastic.
We Spain is on it. My bucket list. So yeah, I would love to do that.
I think it's a great time to go, actually, when it's not super hot. It's mm-hmm. it's not it's just right. You know, there's not like really loads of people, which you would get in the summer.
I have to ask, did you do 12 grapes at midnight?
Because yes, we did.
You did?
We
so did I.
Oh, no. And the other thing I should mention, I haven't even I'm just getting back. We were a bit late getting back. So I'm just, you know, coordinating all of this stuff. I love the way we're really getting into our politics.
I know.
It's fantastic. Isn't it? I'm sure people are loving it. No, guess who else was in Madrid at the same time? Because the grapes reminded me, because she was very excited about doing the grapes for the first time. Ooh. She is a colleague of mine at Fox News. Dana Perino was in Madrid.
I love her. She's so
Isn't
sweet.
That great? She's
that
great.
That is so fun. And those grapes, I do them every year. And I learn the key because I'm always struggling. And if you haven't
heard... Well, you do it here.
Yeah, you're supposed... This is a Spanish tradition, but you're supposed to do 12 grapes in the first minute, basically, before the clock strikes all the way through. And so it's hard. And especially here, because everything's supersized in America. But this year I found small grapes and I put them into cups. And I realized if you actually swallow the grapes altogether, you can get them down. So I'm... Good luck for the rest of the year is
that's
is
amazing
on tap so the for me.
So the other thing I will just say about Spanish customs, New Year customs that I absolutely love, which I'd never, the grapes I've done before, and mm-hmm. I've been in Spain actually for New Year, you know, years ago when we're still living in England. But I'd never been to Barcelona at New Year's. And there's a particular thing, Barcelona, for those who, you know, is part of Catalonia, mm-hmm. which is very much as, you know, like it's obviously part of Spain, but in fact, there's a big independence movement, sees itself very much as a separate culture, speak a different language and so on, Catalan. And there's a Catalan tradition, which I never heard of before. If people follow me on Twitter at Steve Hilton, on X at Steve Hilton X, they can see I posted a picture of this. It's called El Caganer or something like that.
Okay.
And it means the pooping man. And it's literally a figure of a mm-hmm. of a Catalan, like literally poop with his pants down, pooping. And there's a little pile of poop, and the poop signifies good luck. And I think it's something to do with fertility for the soil or whatever. That is literally the thing. And I'm not kidding. And it's even in the nativity scene in the center of Barcelona. They have the nativity, and they all just, and in the corner there's a little pooping man with the poop. And
you gosh, then the LA should be blessed. We have pooping men all over the city.
Exactly. Someone very funnily responded when I posted the picture, something like, yeah, they got this from San Francisco.
That's it. Yeah, give us a little peek into Venice or something.
Anyway, the pooping man. That's and they have hysterical. Shops where you can buy little pooping figurines, you know, all, you know, celebrities and politicians. They obviously have Biden and Trump, whatever, pooping. It's very
funny.
That
is so funny. Anyway. Well, now I know what I need to do
you're
when
not,
I go to
by
Spain.
By the way, just to be clear, the tradition is not to actually poop. That's not how it goes.
Right.
It's just.
We got to be clear. It's the pooping man.
It's a symbol rather than the action. Anyway. All right. Well, I think we're done. That's our conversation.
Good luck, California. See you later.
Good luck. Exactly. That's what we need. So let's look at, it's the start of the year, our first show of the year, first conversation of the year. I wanted to just look ahead to 2024. Obviously, it's a massive year in national politics. We have mm-hmm. the presidential election that's really getting going a week from now. We have the first contest in Iowa. We maybe talk about that in a second. But just in terms of California, actually, we're recording this on Tuesday. For I don't know when people might be hearing it. By the time people listen to this, then they may have heard Gavin Newsom's budget mm-hmm. for California, which he's publishing, I believe, tomorrow. There's this massive deficit, so they've turned around from this great surplus, the $100 billion surplus they were bragging about, which they completely kind of spaffed away by sending out inflation payments or whatever they called it, relief checks. In the run-up to his re-election in 2022. Now we have a massive deficit, $68 billion deficit. So this budget is all about how he's going to close the gap, because you can't have a deficit. So what do you think?
I think that his problem, he's going to have to explain to the rest of the country, because this doesn't look good for someone who wants to run for president, whether it's now or in another 4 years from now. He's going to have to explain how he went from having a so-called surplus, which I think most of us believe was kind of inflated to begin with, to now having this deficit. And it's going to be really hard to explain some of the items in it, whether it's the health care or the entitlement or the billions that he's spending on homeless. And I think this is the biggest piece of the story, is that the stuff they're spending money on seems to be getting worse, not better. Mm. And I think he's going to have a hard time explaining how he's throwing money at crime, at the homeless crisis, at housing, yet we're very slow to see any improvement. So I think this is not the best for him from a national level. And certainly for us in California, I think we know what's going to come around the corner, right? And that's more taxes. They're going to try to get more money out of us, when the truth is they should be reevaluating how they're spending the money that they already have.
So that is absolutely, you nailed it. That is it. And there's a really interesting series of, you know, sort of some commentary around this that I just wanted to share, because it kind of gets to the heart of it. There's an organization called Govern for California, run by a friend of mine, full disclosure, called David Crane, up here in the Bay Area. He's in San Francisco. It's a really significant organization now. They started about 12 years ago, something like that. David Crane previously worked for Arnold Schwarzenegger when he was governor, and realized, and you know, has a he's from the private sector, done very well in business, has a very strong kind of sense of fiscal discipline, and realized that actually the underlying, there's a sort of looming fiscal crisis for California driven by the government unions and the entitlements that they have accumulated over the years, basically in exchange for political support for the Democrats, and specifically pension obligations way in excess of what everyone else can expect. And on top of we talk about the pensions often. On top of that, you've got healthcare, which is again way, way ahead of what most people can get. You get it as when you retire with your, from a government job in California, and it's both at the state level and local government. Absolutely unbelievable generosity in terms of pensions and luxury healthcare. Way more. Even the neighboring Democratic states, I've seen comparisons of, you know, like 30, 40, 50 times higher payments for pensions and healthcare in California than in Oregon and Washington state. So it's not even a partisan thing. It's just totally out of whack. This is what's driving this fiscal position, because as a result of these obligations that are baked in, you have less money for actual services. Right. And so they keep talking, for example, about more money for education. But if you look at the numbers, it's not going to the classrooms, it's not going to kids, it's going to pensions and healthcare for teacher unions who then support them. So the reason for saying all that is that the Government for California has been putting out a series of posts saying this is a real opportunity for Gavin Newsom to, now that he's not running for re-election in California, no longer so dependent on the unions for his political fortunes, to actually finally stand up to them. And instead of raising taxes to fill the gap or cutting services, what he actually could do is reform the real drivers of the fiscal crisis. Will he do it? Interesting. Anyway, that's how they're setting it up. I don't know. I have doubts.
Because he still has political ambitions, I think he's still going to want to stay in the pocket of these unions. And I don't see him standing up to them. And this is why I think it's really important to understand where we are, because, and what David Crane is touching on, when I said we had a surplus, or at least that's what they told us we did, there was always the unfunded pension liabilities that were always in the background of the so-called surplus. And so I never believed we had a surplus to begin with. I think many thinking Californians knew there was a problem there. But now you see what serious crisis we're in, because we still have that imaginary money that's not even being tabulated in with this huge deficit we've got. Exactly. And that's where the problems are.
Exactly. We'll see. I mean, I'm with you. I'm really not optimistic that we're going to see some sort of, I mean, the argument that David Crane makes is this could be great because now it's national ambitions, and I think he called it his LBJ moment. And the argument there was that Lyndon Johnson came in and he'd been from the South, a Democrat, but actually took up civil rights, you know, and took on his party, the Southern Democrats and so on at the time, who were vehemently opposed to civil rights. And he's the one that got it done by standing up to his party. And here's an opportunity for Gavin Newsom to do that. I don't know.
I don't know either. I guess, look, hey, I'm as an optimist, I would think that that's right. And I hope that's what Gavin Newsom does for us in California. And by the way, if he does become president in 4 years or wants to run for national office, I hope. But, you know, we've been disappointed by Gavin Newsom so much. It's hard to expect a turnaround.
Exactly. Let's look at the other big sort of 2024 story politically in California is going to be this Senate race, which is looking more and more interesting because you're suddenly seeing I was just reading this morning, actually, about panicky fundraising emails going out from the Democrat candidates. Remember, the top three Democrats are sort of battling it out. Adam Shifty Schiff, Katie Porter, Barbara Lee from the Bay Area. So Adam Schiff from L.A., Katie Porter from Orange County, Barbara Lee from the Bay Area, all of them current members of Congress. And then for the Republicans, obviously, there's Eric Early. You and I know Eric well. He's been on the show many times. Steve Garvey now is really stepping up. He entered the race quite late, very well known, particularly in Southern California, for his sports legendary status. But now, actually doing, there's a couple of polls that have put him in second place. And it's really interesting reading what the Democrats and the media are saying about this, almost as if it's like, how dare you interrupt what was going to be a Democrat party? And we're going to have two Democrats in the top, in the go through from our top two system into the general election. And it's outrageously some Republican could do it. I mean, it's the tone of the commentary is just staggering. It shows how arrogant they are. But actually, it is true that Steve Garvey is doing well.
You know, and it's interesting because before he entered the race, one of the first polls of the season when Eric Early was the sole Republican in there and the other three Democrat candidates, and there's some other candidates that are you know, swimming around in the pool now as well. But Eric Early was in second place. And that was and it shows you, this is the lesson that we need to send to the Republican Party in California. With a jungle primary system, fewer candidates to allow Democrats to shred themselves when it comes to open seats. And so this has got to be a lesson that as a party, we move forward with. I do think that Adam Schiff has been kind of the chosen one. I believe Nancy Pelosi and Gavin Newsom have all given him support. He made over $6 million, I think, in his last fundraising haul in I think we got numbers from the third or fourth quarter. So he's making the money, and it's no surprise that he's in the top spot. I really do hope we have a choice for conservative voters or for someone who just wants something different. So I hope that Steve Garvey, if that's who it's going to be, is going to be that number two so that at least we make it interesting. You know, obviously for the people of Orange County, they can avoid Katie Porter in Congress and Barbara Lee up in San Francisco. You can avoid that as well. So, I mean, I think that this is good if we can get someone into that second spot. What I'm interested to see is how the debate plays out, because you can have, as of now, the debate's coming up on, I think it's January 22nd, Politico and Fox, I think, across California, the local Fox affiliate. And I am really excited for the first time, number one, to see Steve Garvey speak, because on a stage in front of cameras, we have not seen that yet. He's been kind of untested in that way. There's an opportunity for the Democrats to join together and kind of take him on and challenge some of his ideas. But we know that it's probably more likely they're going to be worried about tearing each other apart. So there's an opportunity, I think, for people who are more moderate or conservative to get the message out. But Eric Early and another candidate, Steve, Christina Pascucci, who's actually a former reporter, she worked at Channel 5 and Channel 11, the Fox affiliate in Los Angeles, for years. She quit the news business and jumped into this race late, like Steve Garvey. She's a Democrat. And both Christina Pascucci and Eric Early came together, Democrat and Republican, to write an op-ed for the Orange County Register this week, talking about how they feel that they should have been included in the debate to really show a diversity of ideas. And they have stated that they didn't know exactly what the stipulations were as to how the candidates were selected and what polls were used. I hope there's another opportunity to get those voices on the stage for California with an open seat like Feinstein's open seat, because LaFonza Butler isn't running. I think it's only fair to the voters to actually let them hear from the candidates who want to speak to them.
Totally agree with that. And it's so important. You know, we keep saying this, you know, we're the biggest state in the union in terms of population, with the fifth largest economy. You know, it really matters who represents us. And at this stage, what is the argument for arbitrarily kind of cutting candidates out? You know, let the voters decide. I think that's right. I mean, Eric has, you know, he's got a long track record of, you know, fighting for a very particular set of ideas. that a lot of people support. And so I think people should hear from him. I agree with that. I don't know Christine.
So
I don't know where she's coming from.
Yeah, and she is definitely a Democrat, but she considers, I think she's pitching herself to be kind of more of a moderate Democrat than some of the other candidates.
So that's a really great point right there as well, because you look at these others, right? There's nothing to, they're totally indistinguishable apart from, you know, as a, you know, Schiff's sort of absolutely, you know, lamentable personal characteristics in terms of his kind of serial pathological lying and so on, right?
But they'll all vote the same.
Right, exactly. And they, I mean, they are literally, I mean, both, I mean, I don't know whether Schiff calls himself this, in the progress, I was going to use the word progressive. Katie Porter and Barbara Lee, both in the progressive camp, called themselves. So what's the difference on policy between them?
They will all vote the same. That's for sure, sitting in that Senate seat. And that's why I think, and here's what really makes a difference. First of all, I don't think anybody has to debate, but you have people that want to debate, and you have such a large chunk of California that's still undecided. If you look at the polls right now, and I'm just kind of going off of my memory here, but I think Adam Schiff was at like 16% and Garvey was around 14%. Katie Porter and Barbara Lee were tied somewhere around 9%. And then I think Eric Early and Christina Pascucci were at 5%. You still have a large chunk of the state who have not made up their mind. And so it's only fair if you have people that are willing to step up on the stage and they are commanding 5%. Because in context to someone at 16%, that's not that far off. I think it makes sense to allow them on that stage. So I hope they'll do a second debate, since the first debate already seems set.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. I mean, the primary is in early March. You know, there's still plenty of time. Mm-hmm. And people aren't, you know, they don't pay attention until the end, often with these elections. But most people probably don't even know that primary is in March. It's been moved. You know, we're used to having them in June in California. Yeah. So, you know, that's different. And so I think you're right. And people aren't really focused on it. So they will be. And this is exactly the time when you want to hear from everyone, I think.
Yeah.
Can we quickly talk about the presidential? Again,
yes.
We're speculating. We're a week out from the first contest, the Iowa caucuses. Something really striking, though, that I just saw today was a poll. A lot of people from New Hampshire, which is the second contest, obviously a week later, and people are saying, and people have been focusing on this poll on the top of the rundown, as it were, where you saw, this is the latest poll from New Hampshire. I can't remember who ran the poll, but you had Trump.
It was Boston Herald, I think.
So, well, this one I'm thinking about, you had Trump on 39, Nikki Haley on 32. Mm-hmm. Then you had, I think it was Chris Christie way behind on 12 or something like that. And then Vivek on like 8. But the thing that really struck me, you have Ron DeSantis in 5th place.
I know.
Right? 5th.
He was supposed to be the guy. I mean, this time last year, Steve, when we were talking, people were saying, wow, Ron DeSantis is going to be a real threat to Trump. He's going to be at the... He has been the disappointment, I think. That's the story, is that, and I really do think that's a personality thing. I don't think it's the policy. I think that ideologically, he shares a lot of the same ideology that Trump does, which has made Trump very popular. Clearly, Nikki Haley's trying to find a distinction between that policy, and she's kind of looking more as the establishment choice or more of the safer choice. But yeah, Ron DeSantis is a real surprise. And the fact that we're sitting here in Iowa after all of the investment from Ron DeSantis, and I think we know that if he doesn't win in Iowa, and it looks like he probably won't, anything can happen in a caucus, but then his campaign's going to be over.
It's over because basically he's nowhere in New Hampshire. I mean, 5th.
No.
It's humiliating. And nowhere
and
in South Carolina.
Carolina.
He's nowhere. So it's
crazy.
Over. It's exactly that. It's absolutely unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, the other thing I just have to say is that there's a lot of excitement, as you say, you know, the establishment crowd saying, oh, look, Nikki Haley could pull it off. If Chris Christie drops out in New Hampshire, then you add him. He's on 12%. That's actually ahead of Trump for the first time. Haley plus Christie in a poll is more than Trump. They're getting very excited about the possibility that Haley could win New Hampshire, right? Okay. But even if she does, it's such a different state, right? Independents vote there. In the Republican primary, it's just completely different. And I just think it's another example of this absolutely hilarious wishful thinking. On the
part cobbling together.
Of the establishment that you know, that can't stand Trump. Okay, let's not get into that. But just as, you know, as analysts, we can say it's just so obvious that kind of anti-Trump group within the Republican Party is a minority. The party wants Trump. I mean, that's just so obvious.
Right. And it's not about what anybody in particular thinks is right or not. It's the people coming together to vote. But it is funny because, and you watch, I know you do this too. As a student of the media, I watch how everybody tries to do this. And the headlines, Nikki Haley surging, she just doubled her support, which was like 6%. So she's at 12 now. So yeah, I guess that's a surge. But if you look at the national polling still with Real Clear Politics, you see that Trump is out at like 60%. And so they're trying to cobble together a story. And I have to tell you, because I love Brian Kilmeade. He's a friend. I respect what he does on TV and the radio. But a few months ago, I heard him on Fox and Friends, and he said that if Chris Christie could pull off a win in New Hampshire, then there would be a chance. And he's trying to create the path as to how Chris Christie could get the nomination. And I'm thinking to myself,
oh, that's hilarious.
You know, you can't, I mean, as much as you want to cobble together stories, let's say Nikki Haley wins New Hampshire, and let's say, and I don't think she will, win South Carolina, you still have the rest of the country. And,
exactly.
You know, it's tough to overcome.
Yeah, that's exactly that. I mean, you know, that is exactly, even if everything goes well for the anti, you know, so that you know, you have Trump wins Iowa, but by less than expected. So there's a kind of sense of a sort of lack of momentum. And then Chris Christie drops out and his, you know, I think the number was 65% of his supporters give Haley as their second choice. So let's say that happens. And let's say she wins New Hampshire. I don't even think looking at the polls, she's way behind in South Carolina in her own state. So I don't even see how she wins that, let alone all these massive contests on Super Tuesday. As you say, the rest of the country is where they haven't been investing all this effort and money.
Yeah, her best chance is New Hampshire. It's not even her own state of South Carolina. And the other thing that people have to remember, and this is just a gut feeling. This is not based on any poll or anything that I've seen or read. But if DeSantis does drop out of Iowa, I believe the bulk of his support goes to Trump.
I think
DeSantis voters, Trump is number two. And for Trump voters, even though they don't like to say it, DeSantis is number two. I think Chris Christie's voters will go to Nikki Haley, but then you have Vivek.
And they'll all be Trump. Yeah,
they'll be Trump. So it's really, it is an uphill climb. You know, good luck. Everybody's fair and in the game. And this is the great part of the process is that everybody gets to show up. And, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire are weird states the way they vote, and they can determine some momentum. But it does seem to be Trump's year. And we'll see what happens, I guess.
We will. Exactly. Yeah. All right, Jen. Great to look into the crystal ball for this year. Fantastic to see you. Happy New Year again.
You too. I've missed you. Happy New Year to everyone.
See you very soon.
Bye.
All right, here's something I want to get off my chest, which is the absolutely shocking state of American higher education, our universities. Of course, we all are focused on that because of the scandal of the anti-Semitism, Claudine Gay and those people in the testimony, Elise Stefanik and all of that, that should put them on the spot and revealed the completely outrageous kind of left-wing mentality that's just driven our universities into the ditch. But there's something actually underlying all that I think just doesn't get enough attention. Because while all this has been going on, I spoke about this on Stuart Varney's show on Fox Business the other day, is that it's not just, and this has now been framed. If you look at Claudine Gay in her pathetic piece that she wrote for the New York Times defending herself, and as totally predictable, blaming her downfall on racism, because of course she would say that. But actually, despite their efforts to frame all this as a partisan attack by Republicans, by the right, by the far right, as they endlessly say, on her and her colleagues and on American universities and trying to bring these institutions down. They are bringing the institutions down themselves because of the way that they've been behaving. And it's not just, of course, it's revealed all this. The anti-Semitism has just put it in the spotlight. But this has been going on for years, even decades. And it's not just Republicans who feel like this, because now you're seeing survey evidence come out that Democrats and independents are also, you're seeing a collapse of trust and faith in American universities right across the board politically. And why is that? It's not just because of this anti-Semitism. It is because for years now, people can see the truth, which is in terms of the university system in this country, the higher education that's provided, it is a classic example of a service where the cost has gone up and the quality has come down. And of course, if that happens, you think less of it. And that's what's been going on. That equation moving in the wrong direction. You're paying more and more for college, and parents having to cough up, or people having to take out loans, and the loans are crippling for young people as they go through their first years of their working lives and so on. We know all that story. So the costs are crippling and the quality is a disaster. You talk to people and employers who are hiring graduates, and these people can barely, write properly, let alone make an argument or operate in the workforce. Of course, that's a massive generalization, but generally speaking, you talk to employers and they lament the quality, the intellectual ability, the academic training of students that coming out of our university system. The cost is going up, the quality is going down. And there's one thing that actually explains both parts of that equation, and that is the absolutely astonishing growth over the last more than few years, the last couple of decades, in bureaucrats and administrators in our universities. So these people add barely any value at all. This is where all the DEI nonsense is coming from, and all this crap that's kind of clogging up the system, or the bureaucrats and administrators. And this is not a small thing. I mean, there's a report that was out on this last year. Astonishingly, across the American university system, you now have a situation where there are more bureaucrats than teachers, not just a few more, a lot more. On average, across the system, there are three times as many administrators in American universities than teachers. I mean, what are they doing? They're not teaching. They're not improving anyone's education. They're not doing anything in terms of the traditional function of a university for, teaching people and promoting the free and open exploration of different ideas and all that kind of stuff that we look to the universities to do. They're not doing any of that. They're bureaucrats. And there are across American universities, three times as many of them as there are teachers. And you look at individual universities, and the more elite, often the worse it gets. It's even worse than that. Johns Hopkins, 7.5 times as many bureaucrats as teachers. MIT, right? MIT, that was one of the people, she was one of the people, the president of MIT up there with Claudine Gay in that hearing. MIT now has 9 times as many bureaucrats as teachers. I mean, what is this? I mean, in some of these universities, you have more, astonishingly, but it's true, you have more bureaucrats than students. In 2 California universities, that just in the report I saw, more administrators than students. In Stanford University, there are more administrators than there are undergraduates. There's about 10,000 bureaucrats and 7 or 8,000 undergraduates. I mean, no wonder it's all going to shit, because you have these left-wing ideologues hired in these administrative positions who push out the dogma and the indoctrination instead of actually teaching anyone anything. That's the problem at the heart of all this. And so the final point I'd make is, which again, I made this point with Stuart Varney, where he said, well, how you turn that around? I mean, that is a long-term trend that's been going in the wrong direction for years. Of course, that's true. And my point was, it's going to be practically impossible to reform these totally broken institutions. What is the answer? A classic American answer, an entrepreneurial answer, which is to build something better. And thankfully, that is exactly what is happening. And you have some fantastic people, they're friends of mine, full disclosure, who are literally creating a new university. They're building it in Austin, Texas. It's called the University of Austin, Texas, UATX. And they are building what they plan to be a world-class university to compete with Harvard and Stanford and all these places, but totally committed to free expression and open inquiry and proper teaching, and without all this garbage and all these administrators and bureaucrats, but going back to what a university should be all about. And to me, that is really exciting, because it's that competition from something better that is going to clean up this mess that is actually really destructive for our country. All right, great to be back with you after what was quite a long break. Hope you didn't miss me too much. 2024 is going to be a great year. Hope you enjoy it with us here on The Steve Hilton Show. Make sure you tell all your friends about the show. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. And we will see you back here soon for the next episode of The Steve Hilton Show.